You say the neurotic version of agency gets mistaken for the real thing, leaving women less satisfied and also less free. So I guess my question here is, like, could you have such a thing as a neurotic view of freedom? Is that what we're talking about here? But maybe before that, could you explain to us what is neurosis? Because this is a term that obviously psychoanalysts like to throw around. But you know, as we were talking before recording, sometimes defining these kind of starting terms is easier said than done.
Yeah, it's a good question. Psychoanalytic terminology is so saturated and maybe hard to define simplistically. But if I were to try to define neurosis simplistically, it's unresolved internal conflict.
Right. That's a very snappy definition.
Wait, that's more succinct than I was expecting.
Yeah, sorry. I was.
I think we are talking about a neurotic kind of freedom. Neurosis often robs us of a lot of life. It's very paralyzing. Mm. I do think our society just makes it too easy to be neurotic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to BungaCast. My name is Alex Hochuli. I'm in São Paulo, Brazil. And this is another episode in partnership with Damage Magazine, a very good magazine we all heartily recommend, because I'm here with a fellow Bunga boy, George Hoare, who's in London. Hi, George.
Hey.
And if you don't know yet, you probably do if you're a regular listener, George and I are part of the editorial group of Damage. And we are joined today by another person on the editorial group, Amber Trotter. Hi, Amber.
Hi there.
So Amber, I'll introduce her briefly before setting up this episode. She's a psychologist in private practice in San Francisco. She's an editor at Damage Magazine, as I already mentioned, and the author of a book which came out a couple of years ago, Psychoanalysis as a Subversive Phenomenon. We've discussed maybe some of the ideas which kind of exist in the same space as that a while back. I mean, we discussed Elie Zaretsky's book on psychoanalysis in the Reading Club, which listeners might want to check out. It's actually a book that I think that you cite in your book, Amber. So I think that's kind of interesting. So what we're going to be discussing today is issues related to an article that Amber has in the new print edition of Damage. The issue itself is called Mothers, and we've already explored one article from that issue with Amber Lee Frost, different Amber, about trad wives and influencers. And we did that a couple of weeks ago, so you might want to check that out if you haven't heard that already. But today we turn to maybe a weightier topic of the particular kind of freedom that women are offered through reproductive technologies like egg freezing. And I would encourage you, obviously, to pick up the magazine, to subscribe to the magazine, and to definitely read Amber's article on it, on these issues, because it explodes a whole bunch of different issues. And as a way to kind of get started, I think I will ask Amber to tell us the story of Michael and Mindy to Anna Lizanz of hers. And it's a story whereby Mindy and her decision to freeze her embryos allows her to, and I'm quoting from Amber's article, leave an internal conflict unresolved. ART, or artificial reproductive technology, offered this couple a frozen freedom that suspended their life, an agency engineered to evade a choice. So there's loads in there, and that's really nicely phrased. So maybe you could unpack it for us, Amber.
Of course, my pleasure. I'm so delighted to be joining you today. The people that I describe in the article are not quite real people. They're fictionalized, composite stories based on a lot of clinical experience, and I just want to mention that. It's always tricky to write about clinical material and maintain confidentiality, but working in San Francisco for a long period of time, I've actually had the occasion to work with many different couples and individuals around the topic of egg freezing and IVF and other artificial reproductive technologies. So in this story that I tell in the Damage article, two people in their mid-30s in a committed partnership feel a bit conflicted about a desire to begin a family and transition into a more conventional sort of phase of life that happens after marriage and a sort of fuller family, buying a house, these sorts of things, and a desire to continue with the lifestyle that they were currently enjoying very much. The sort of work hard, play hard, San Francisco ethos, going to Burning Man, traveling a lot for work, having a bunch of fun. There was quite a conflict. And in the way I tell it, Michael, the heterosexual man in the couple, was more in favor of beginning a family, and Mindy felt much more conflicted. She didn't want to give up a certain kind of freedom to move in the world unencumbered by pregnancy, by children. And the couple began to sort of work through this conflict in therapy, but fairly quickly decided to just freeze embryos as a way of delaying this choice, right? As a way of maintaining optionality, in some sense, being able to do both things at once instead of working through resolving the conflict. And for all that the vast majority of people do not have insurance that covers artificial reproductive technologies here in San Francisco, many tech companies do, in fact, offer insurance that covers these kinds of procedures. So they were able to freeze these embryos and delay the decision. They bought a house that was sort of satisfying a kind of need to transition into a different phase of life for Michael. In the end, they just kicked this decision down the road and wound up still being able to work through it years later. The conflict sort of intensified when it came up again, and Mindy said, well, I think I'll be ready in a couple of years. First, I want to open the relationship up and actually see other people and in a way expand freedom, live a sort of even more free life before committing to having children, which to Mindy felt like a bit of a sentence. Like my freedoms will be terminated when I become a mom. Many women have this sort of aversion to motherhood, to becoming a mom, I think because it feels constraining or constrictive through a certain philosophical paradigm. So at any rate, they opened up their relationship, and to no one's surprise, things did not work out. The marriage dissolved, and both people were in pretty rough emotional places behind it. And I think Mindy in particular, I really felt for and was empathetic towards in the article. By the time the marriage dissolved, she was 40. They destroyed the embryos as they were, you know, the product of the both of them. And she probably won't end up having a family. That's kind of how I leave this vignette. And I'm not sure that that's really ultimately what she wanted.
Mm. So, I mean, it occurred to me listening to you talk about this, that the, you know, technology offering up the possibility of not having to make a choice is tantalizing. It's not by accident, and I'm not by no means the first person to make this comment, but the kind of one neat trick sort of language of internet marketing, right? Of like banner ads and stuff like this, this one neat trick that solved all the person's problems. Like in a way, artificial reproductive technology is, for I think a lot of the women and the people that you describe in your article, a bit that kind of seemingly that one neat trick that obviates the need to really make a choice, at least for now, or you're able to kind of kick the can down the road. I mean, it might be worth just setting up kind of what the, just on a basic level, what the kind of, not legal, but more kind of financial situation is in insurance terms and whatever actuarial situation in the US, in the UK, George, if you want to comment on that.
Well, no, I guess one of my sort of questions would be, I mean, is this a particularly American phenomenon? And if so, who does it? Who freezes their eggs? Because I think in the kind of the vignettes that you weave through the article, there's a lot of, it was covered by their insurance. There's a kind of material aspect to that. But before I ask, ask that question, just on the, I think the central idea of like buying time, this made me think of Wolfgang Streich's work, this idea that essentially since the 1970s, particularly Western European governments, I mean, this might or might not be a good analogy, but I'm going to go with it anyway. And then Amber, you can say if I'm talking nonsense. Since the 1970s, what have governments been doing to kind of try to resolve crises of various different sorts, particularly economic? It's all been processes of buying time, of delaying, and eventually that time will run out, and that decision has to be made, or that crisis has to be faced. But that's probably a bit of a side point. So in terms, I guess, then of this, you know, the scale of this, is it a widespread kind of thing in the US? Who does it? Is it expensive? I mean, I know the answer to that last question in particular. Maybe just paint that for us a little bit. Who's engaging in this kind of practice?
I do think that you're both pointing to sort of seductive aspects of neoliberal freedom that we can dive into perhaps later. But a magical solution, a kind of freedom through wanting too much to occur through a technological fix. So it's actually quite interesting who is freezing their eggs has shifted a bit over time. Before I get more into that, I do think that there's such a fantasy around technology and many of the things that we're capable of doing today, that it will solve all of our intrapsychic emotional conflicts and problems, that it will be this friction-free freedom, and that we can have it all, right? And I do think that that bit around delaying things in the service of having it all, of a kind of omnipotent freedom through sequentially delaying, reflects an earlier demographic concentration of people engaging in egg freezing. Historically, and not a long history here, but not such a long time ago, more of the women freezing their eggs were affluent professional women wanting to focus first on career and then on family, a way of having it all just a little bit sequentially. So you could get that promotion, focus on your career, spend more time going all in on that part of your life, with the security of having your eggs frozen, and then be able to have a family when it was kind of the right point professionally. When I started doing a little research for this paper, I imagined that is what I would find, and a kind of cynical economic incentive there to sort of seduce women to perhaps focus on career and then maybe not wind up having a family, but a promise of being able to have it all. That's what I thought I would find. Interestingly, so many women freezing their eggs are saying that they're ready to have a family financially and emotionally, but they can't find a mate, and that currently demographics seem to reflect this quote unquote mating gap that has been broadly discussed, that what maybe seems like a problem for women trying to manage all of the demands of contemporary life is perhaps more of this sort of crisis of masculinity that we've discussed plenty at Damage. But there's this medical anthropologist at Yale who did a deep dive on egg freezing and interviewed lots of women, sort of an exit interview, leaving egg freezing clinics. And the majority of them were women in their 30s who could, in theory, have a baby in a healthy way biologically and wanted to have a family like now, but couldn't seem to find an eligible partner. And additionally, more and more women are actually freezing their eggs quite young.
Mm. Just as an early insurance policy.
As a sort of insurance policy, right? 28-year-old women, well, if you're going to have to do it eventually, you might as well do it now because you're younger and healthier. Your eggs will never be better. You have the job that covers it now, so might as well.
Yeah, I don't know whether in the UK it's available on the National Health Service, George. In Brazil, it's available but to oncology patients, but on the kind of National Health Service here. And I was just looking this up and I saw that the practice of freezing one's eggs has increased by 100% between 2020 and 2023. So kind of over the pandemic period and a little bit after. And that's just here in Brazil. So obviously it's a phenomenon which is happening in many different places, even if the kind of specific gender relations and this problem of kind of a desynchronization between kind of what men want and what women want might differ a little bit from country to country. But I guess the specific type of neoliberal freedom that we're here to kind of discuss and the way that technological fixes can try to resolve those issues or provide a certain notion of freedom, maybe that's pretty universal today. It's interesting. I think, I mean, you note in the article, Amber, that, you know, it's high cost in those countries where it's not kind of publicly available and has a relatively low success rate of like 30 to 40%. And something like only 12% of all frozen eggs are ultimately actually used. So there's a lot of people going through the process, but not actually getting a baby out of it at the end. There's high costs. So the desire has to be, it must be immense, but you know, you do get a baby out of it. At least that's the promise. And what could be more empowering than female emancipation from bio, repro, chrono limitations and compulsions, which I think is right. I mean, it's interesting to, you know, kind of put it so starkly. And I wonder what your political read on it is in terms of who this freedom is promised to. Whether it can have a universal sort of basis, even if it's limited to those whose insurance plans cover it. And therefore, I think in the US, at least, it seems to be a fairly slender proportion of the population.
It's a good question. There's a lot in that question. I do think that there's a lot of interesting things to say about freedom. One thing that maybe is worth simplifying a bit or clarifying is that in psychoanalytic terms, a mature freedom, a freedom that hopefully we develop in adulthood, involves working within limits, really finding freedom within limits. A more infantile kind of freedom involves an omnipotence, a fantasy that we can just have whatever we want, that is freedom. And there's a lot of beautiful writing in psychoanalysis about mature adult freedom of accepting limits and also pushing up against them, right? We don't want to just conform to the demands of reality in some deadening sort of constricted way, but we also don't want to chafe against limits too much, like something like that, kind of finding creative, agentic freedom within limits and within, you know, the confines of reality, of the body, of mortality, of sort of all of these things, right? That there's a mature kind of freedom that I think psychoanalysis helps us to understand. And I think something really interesting has happened politically, in which there's a desire for a more, I don't know, infantile kind of freedom, and then mistaking that for collective political liberation or something like that, to be able to transcend the limits of our bodies or something like this. And it's such a tricky subject, and I'm really genuinely sort of interested in it because it's so slippery to try to think through. On the one hand, we do want to be capable of making more and more sort of choices for ourselves or removing obstacles, but is this the right place to focus? Is this the obstacle we really want to remove? And I think that's the politically interesting thing, is so much attention politically ends up being focused on somebody's right to freeze their eggs so that they can have children a decade later than is biologically hardwired, or so that someone can transition to a different gender because they feel that makes them more psychologically well-adjusted. And I know this is controversial stuff to get in, but I do think there's something interesting here politically of a way that a conversation moves to this sort of insistence on individuals' rights to make choices with their bodies or their lives in these particular kinds of ways. It can often feel like it's taking up an awful lot of oxygen in comparison to me more compelling ideas of collective freedom to, you know, change the economic superstructure of our country or something, something like that.
But yeah, I mean, I was going to mention the trans question as well, just not to delve into it, but as a touch point, I think it's a well-trod point by now, but it's still worth repeating. And to a certain extent, I'm repeating what you've just said, Amber, but of seeking to transform your own body in lieu of social transformation, as that horizon seems to close, people kind of turn inward and try to find particularly technologically enabled ways of transforming themselves. And it's difficult, I think, in response to that to say, well, no, we're going to put more limits on what you can do on your personal autonomy. You don't want to necessarily close off avenues. But as you say, maybe it's a question more of attention and of political energy and just in general kind of social energy and discussion that is directed towards those forms of transformation as opposed to social transformation. George?
Just a question on this. I don't know if you'd actually be able to answer it, but does and maybe to generalize across maybe people that you've spoken to in your practice around this, but does it feel like freedom? Does the act of freezing eggs feel like freedom to people who do it, or does it feel like avoidance? Like, is there a knowledge that actually there's a kind of a really difficult internal crisis or struggle that's being avoided, or is it actually embraced? Because I guess that is one of the things about neoliberal freedoms, is that they must feel like freedoms at least some of the time to resonate with all of us when we make our choices in the marketplace. I'm drinking a delicious can of Coca-Cola, great brand. We're not sponsored by them, but you know, if you work there and would like to investigate that, do get in touch. But yeah, there must be something about this that really makes people feel I'm expressing myself, or I'm doing things I couldn't otherwise do.
Absolutely. I think so. One of the things I really love about being a clinical psychologist is you're forced to reckon with how things really show up to real people in their lives. And it's so easy to lose track of that in more academic settings. Well, that couldn't really feel like freedom. But of course, it feels very liberating and empowered, especially initially. I think part of the tragedy of so many neoliberal forms of freedom is that eventually they ring hollow. Mindy, in this story that I shared at first, wound up feeling fairly disempowered. I haven't gotten any of what I wanted. But omnipotent choice is very seductive, isn't it? I like to go to the supermarket and be able to choose from 30 different kinds of whatever product. It's actually interesting. It's part of what people don't want to relinquish. If they think about broader social changes or a more socialist kind of model, no, I want to be able to choose exactly what I want and do exactly what I want. Of course, it's seductive. Yeah. And I think if you don't, like, we don't know what we don't know. I do think that agency is such an important question for mental health, for politics, how much we feel we can make an impact or how free we feel to do different things. And we like to feel more agency, even if it's all ultimately an illusion. We feel better when we feel more of a sense of agency. And if the only kind of agency we know is individual choice, then we're going to cling to that. But I think sometimes people aren't aware of the sorts of freedoms that are foreclosed.
I wanted to get onto some of the kind of gendered aspects of it, but just before that, what struck me hearing you talk about it just a second ago, but also from the article that you note that, you know, the kind of type of freedom is an absence from constraint, freedom from the body, from sex, and from time. And especially that last one, I think, resonated with me because, you know, as you say, it's the appeal of freezing one's eggs is in a way to kind of kick the can down the road. That buys you time. It liberates you from the anxiety of needing to choose. And so we want to have choice, but you don't want to have to choose. And I think that, like, that's one of the things that we're faced with, right? You want to have all these potential options open to you, but you don't want to have to actually opt for one of them, because that means closing off other avenues inevitably. And I think that's what we're stuck with. So I wonder how do you understand this relationship between choice, agency and anxiety, because they seem kind of closely related, and it's suggested quite a bit by your article.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's such a great question. And it relates to your question, George. In a way, it feels good, right? It's seductive, but actually can create a lot of anxiety and ultimately a lot of disappointment that if we keep all of the doors open, we end up not walking through any of them, right? It's that frozen freedom piece that I tried to capture in the title. There is this paradox that we want to be able to choose, but then we try to have all of the choices available to us. Want to delay it forever. Like people have this fantasy of wanting to live forever, like to not die, right? It really brings it to the crux of the matter. And it's like, no, part of what makes life great and part of what gives you freedom is knowing that you're going to die and that it's finite. And then you have to sink both feet into it.
No, freedom is having a blood boy that you can transfuse, you know, life-giving, youthifying blood to you.
Like how just deadening, actually, the concept of living forever, or how deadening the concept of not having a body. I do think that paradoxically, at a certain point, too much choice creates anxiety. And there's so much to respond to here. I'm thinking about existential philosophy and Sartre and this sort of the way that we need to embrace the anxiety of ultimately getting to choose. Right, that we ultimately do get to choose. There's something very positive about that anxiety, but also it can be so paralyzing if it's kind of too much. Maybe we used to want more choice historically because there was less of it, and now that there's so much of it, it becomes paralyzing. There's this interesting psychological study that is coming to mind. I couldn't cite it particularly, but I remember reading this in graduate school a long time ago, where people were told that they received some sort of prize. Congratulations, you get a prize. And in one group, they were allowed to choose between three sort of nice prizes. And in one group, they just got one of these three nice prizes. And then they check in with people 6 months later, who's happier with their prize. We can guess the answer here. The people who were just given one of the three nice prizes were much more content.
Yeah, no. It's. I mean, it's one of the kind of classic themes of existentialism, isn't it? It definitely makes me think of Sylvia Plath's Fig Tree. All the, you know, you're sitting there in the fig tree. You could eat any of the figs, and whilst you're deciding which fig to eat, they all go off. I guess this is kind of the, and also it makes me think of a discussion we had about Martin Hagelin's book, like why mortality gives life meaning, and because it basically means you can only choose one thing or the other. You have to express what you think is valuable about your life through the things that you do. It's kind of a core existentialist point, but I think it's right. And I think this is probably, there must be something about avoiding that very weighty, scary freedom that appeals to all of us. I'm not, you know, not judging people who would like to find a simple hack, as you put, Alex, to kind of get around the weight of freedom. That would be something that would, you know, if you know how to do that, please do write in and tell us, because certainly on my mind quite a lot what to do with this freedom. It's sometimes easier to just be able to do everything.
So I mean, I wanted to ask, because it's also suggested in your piece that the egg freezing, I mean, it's understood as a woman's issue, obviously, naturally, and it being something which is tied to women's anxieties running out of time, of fertility clock, or indeed of not finding a suitable mate. And I think that pushes us in a different direction. And what you suggest in the article, Amber, is that this is evocative of a male crisis, not of a female crisis, that it's a male crisis of maybe not wanting children, which maybe runs counter to the example that you gave at the start of Michael and Mindy. But in general, I think you're suggesting that it's more men not wanting children and women then being forced or feeling like they're forced into having to freeze their eggs because of a lack of choice, because of lack of options, of lack of a suitable mate. So it's kind of the opposite side of the question.
Yeah, that does open up a whole other part of things. But it does seem to be the data is that so many women who are freezing their eggs can't seem to find a suitable mate who's ready to have children or who wants to. And perhaps one might say that men don't need egg freezing. to sort of delay this choice, we'll cross that bridge later. I'm not ready yet. There's this whole phenomenon in the Bay Area of this kind of Peter Pan archetype of men who aren't ready to settle down yet or have a family yet. So they've already been in this kind of delayed choice or frozen freedom without needing egg freezing to facilitate that, right? So something perhaps like that. I do think, you know, psychoanalytically, part of how we deal with the anxiety of making choices is to be more conscious about it, to work through internal conflict. Making the unconscious conscious is one of the core tenets of psychoanalysis. And there's this idea that, look, we're making choices freely all of the time, but so often it feels like life is happening to us, you know? We have some explosion of anger and it has major consequence. Maybe we get fired from our job and it feels like, gosh, I just lost my temper. This happened to me. But actually it was you getting that angry or out of control. And the idea is that with a good analysis, we become more self-aware. We really home in on what we want and we think through trade-offs and we make choices a bit more consciously. That's not the whole of a psychoanalytic take on freedom. There are many different facets of freedom, I think, from a psychoanalytic perspective. But one is sort of increasing our capacity to understand ourselves and our desire and to kind of move towards that with more agency and clarity. And so I think that even though it still creates anxiety, maybe less so. And in a way, this kind of Peter Pan archetype or freezing your eggs, it's kicking that anxiety or internal conflict down the road.
Mm. And I mean, it seems like it is expressed more in women because men can kind of keep, you know, a foot in many camps at once and don't, you know, whereas women can't have it all nowadays, you know, can have professional, maternal and romantic goals and try to go after all of them. But women have to stick a foot in, I don't know, to maybe the metaphor doesn't work anymore, but, you know, kind of step through some of the doors a little in a more convincing and determined fashion than men have to. I mean, specifically with motherhood, which is the hardest commitment, the most kind of more fundamental commitment of all, that there's no kind of dabbling. You can't dabble a bit in motherhood while you also, you know, kind of sleep around and also have a career and also maybe don't take your career seriously and all these things at once. And so I think it maybe expresses itself more with women. Let me rephrase the question. Do you think it expresses itself differently psychologically for women than for men?
Gosh, one thing that came to my mind is, oh, the connection between what I see personally and psychologically and bigger discourse around freedom and politics, that because there's this biological clock for women, and because it's women who can get pregnant, who have to get pregnant, there can be so much resentment for women. It feels unfair. And I think it circles us back to this kind of political conversation about freedom that to me doesn't feel much like political freedom. Women often feel like it's just not fair, or wouldn't it be great if their male partner could get pregnant and have the baby? Like, this isn't fair. I have to go through this. I have to be the one to take maternity leave and go through labor and all of this. I hear this really commonly and I'm struck by it. I'm curious about it. Instead of sort of finding freedom within constraint or within limitations, there's this fantasy of some perfect freedom where one isn't constrained by gender, by the body, but right? And then a sort of resentment that one is.
Hmm. I mean, I'm sure this plays out for men in similar ways, although from the other side of the, you know, other side of the coin, which is like, well, you know, women are wanting me to settle down or wanting me to commit to kids or not do blah, blah, and I just want to continue to exercise this freedom that I have. Why do I have to, why does this choice get imposed upon me? Which, of course, is kind of a pretty infantile, I think, reaction, but nevertheless, you know, I think it's, there's probably kind of a lot of finger pointing, thinking this isn't fair on both sides. And I think this is expressed quite a lot nowadays. Maybe this is a bit of a sidebar, but so many contemporary anxieties and kind of conflicts and contradictions get expressed in gender terms when they're not really about gender, but they get expressed like this. So in this case, you know, people's uncertainty about an inability sometimes to have a family, you know, for social and for financial and whatever reasons, that gets then kind of creates these kind of tensions between the genders. I mean, in heterosexual relationships anyway, which obviously have something underlying them. But I think it may, for a lot of people, they, you know, it's because of the men are all bad or the women are all whatever, you know, et cetera. Like, and that's how these things get expressed. I want to move us on to the kind of neoliberal freedom and its limitations, you know, and turn to this a little bit more specifically. I don't know, as again, a little bit of a sidebar, I don't know if neoliberal is even the right term, because it's certainly a vision of individual freedom. But I can imagine a world in which the neoliberal age is eclipsed by some other form of management, but we're left with the same kind of desiccated form of freedom or even less freedom. So maybe it's kind of deliberal rather than neoliberal. It's kind of in some ways an undoing of the older liberal promise of freedom. But maybe that we can explore another time unless someone wants to take that up. What did strike me listening to your article, and we've already mentioned reading your article, and we've already kind of touched on this, is Salta's book, The Age of Reason, which was written in the mid-40s. And it's very, I couldn't avoid thinking about it because it's so, it touches so much on these issues of commitment, freedom, anxiety, and specifically in relation to children and like having children as a kind of avatar of commitment, of effectively stepping through a door, which means that other doors necessarily sort of close. And, you know, in that novel, the protagonist, Mathieu, it takes place over the course of just a couple of days. And Mathieu is a philosophy professor, and he's kind of just running around, and his mistress, I guess, is pregnant, and he's trying to scramble together funds to get her an abortion, to maintain his independence, which is like the fundamental issue there. And it seems like a great stand for freedom that he's making because he wants to retain his independence. You think, yeah, well, that's a worthy thing to do. You know, you want to maintain your independence, not be dependent and whatever. But what actually becomes clear, and Mathieu has this moment of kind of realization, of maturation, that he needs to make a choice, you know, that by avoiding choices, you're not really making any choice, and you kind of imprison yourself in this life of you know, indecision and alienation. So he enters the age of reason, I think, if I remember the kind of conclusion correctly. He enters the age of reason when he grapples with this idea of responsibility and realizes that, you know, freedom can only really be expressed through commitment, not through the absence of commitment. Anyway, I thought that was, I couldn't help kind of returning to that novel in kind of reading the article, because it seems to express so well something which, you know, this is Sartre doing this in the mid-40s, and society actually ended up taking a quite different direction with regard to the notion of freedom and commitment, I think.
Mm-hmm. What a lovely association. And it is fascinating to think about the 40s and the trajectory since then. I agree with you, neoliberals, maybe not the right frame. And it would be interesting to think about, is there a right frame? But if we just stick with commitment for a moment, there are some forms of freedom that only come through commitment, right? There's a kind of freedom that only comes through really fully committing to something. And it's a hard freedom to try to articulate. And perhaps we don't have lived experience with that kind of freedom, and so we don't value it. It makes me think about the sort of deterioration of the social fabric of all different kinds of institutions and commitments. We've been talking recently about place and commitment to place and to a geographic community. But I think as the fabric of society has frayed more and more, all we are sort of left with is freedom from constraint instead of freedom to do certain things that come through collectivity and commitment, right? Something like that. And so if that's all you've got, then you sort of chafe against anything that feels like a constraint or a commitment. And there's a reason we think so much about parenthood here, why egg freezing really draws a lot of this to a head, is because it's a big commitment that people want as individuals, right? If there's this notion of freedom that is being able to pursue whatever I personally, individually just want to do, being able to express myself without restraint. And you see this in all kinds of places, that my job, my freedom, my happiness comes from being able to just express myself as freely and fully as possible. Well, having a kid kind of butts up against that. It's like, oh, I think I want this, but this is going to really interfere with this basic project. And so a lot kind of comes to a head, but it's not just kids. It's like all kinds of things require commitment and closing doors, right? And being part of things bigger than oneself, ultimately.
Which is, I think, something which maybe a lot of people do want, but find it, I would say, more difficult perhaps than previously, if you do follow the kind of, you know, collapse of the institution's general theme. People are disembedded, and maybe it is that is the kind of fundamental kind of quality of this sort of freedom that is being kind of expressed here, is that if you are, the more disembedded you are in reality, and the more that you're not involved in a kind of network of institutions, the more that you probably would, you know, the reality of your life is that the freedoms that you have are more individual. They are more about avoiding commitments and avoiding being embedded, because embeddedness is simultaneously a constraint, a commitment, and a restriction. And these things are, you know, they're all complex. I guess, though, I did want to ask you about one part of the, or maybe even just one phrase even of the article, where you say, so kind of talking about agency, which obviously very closely related to freedom, you say the neurotic version of agency gets mistaken for the real thing, leaving women less satisfied and also less free. So I guess my question here is, like, could you have such a thing as a neurotic view of freedom? Is that what we're talking about here? But maybe before that question, if that question even makes sense, could you explain to us what is neurosis? Because this is a term that obviously psychoanalysts like to throw around, but you know, as we were talking before recording, sometimes defining these terms, these kind of starting terms, is easier said than done. So that's why I'm asking you to do it rather than doing it myself.
Yeah, it's a good question. Psychoanalytic terminology is so saturated and maybe hard to define simplistically. But if I were to try to define neurosis simplistically, it's unresolved internal conflict.
Right. That's a very snappy definition.
Wait, that's more succinct than I was expecting.
Yeah, sorry. I was expecting it to be longer. But that, so is then the things that we call neurotic, are those the symptoms of the neurosis then? Is that the way to think about it?
Yes.
Because people yes. Like, if you, mental picture, at least from it, for me, like of what neurotic is it's kind of a sort of set of behaviors, and maybe that's, you know, the distinction between the neurosis and the neurotic symptoms.
What we think of as neurotic, I think, is a sort of manifestation of neurosis, right? The symptoms of being highly anxious or self-defeating or caught in one's head, right? People who joke, oh, I'm so neurotic. Part of what they mean is that they are in their head, to use the lingo of the moment, and obsessing or overthinking or spiraling because they can't just make a choice, or they can't just do what feels right because they're internally conflicted, right? They actually don't know.
So anything living rent-free in your own head.
Well, if you want someone's head to live rent-free, and it probably should be your own.
And I think we are talking about a neurotic kind of freedom. Neurosis often robs us of a lot of life. It's very paralyzing.
Well, instead of it being this carnival of choice, if you want to enjoy that, you know, it's seen as a kind of imposition or, you know, paralyzing, I guess, right? So that's the way
it's right. Kind of, like a neurotic, just to be kind of silly about it, a neurotic approach to what do I want to have for dinner might involve looking at a whole bunch of takeout menus and spending half an hour on my phone and then calling a friend and talking to my friend about it and then ending up ordering nothing for dinner and going to sleep because it's just...
Yeah. Yeah, or choosing what movie to watch with your partner and you know, ending up with nothing.
Watching all of the trailers. And I do think our society just makes it too easy to be neurotic, right? If there's only one show on TV or three stations on the radio, then you just like, you, it's easier to pick one. But this endless choice, you see it with dating apps. If you can look at everything, it can wind up... getting in the way of making a choice or almost making us neurotic.
But I like the idea that it is that dynamic between, it's not just the fact that there's lots of things to choose from. It is also the internal conflict, which is unresolved and that we allow ourselves not to resolve, or that we look for things which kind of postpone the resolution of that conflict. I think if they're, because I'm sure we've all been there, you know, what are you going to have for dinner after work, and you can't be bothered to cook, and oh, but maybe you should. And that's part of the unresolved internal conflict. If there was a way to just solve this without feeling the guilt, without having to eat anything, yeah, that would be an attractive option.
Well, transhumanism. That's the transhumanism option. You've got a technology, you upload your brain to the cloud and you no longer have to eat and you don't have to make that choice anymore.
I just want a pill that just resolves the guilt from not being able to choose what to have for dinner. I think
well, there's a novel by Benjamin Kunkel, Indecision, in which he takes a pill, or he's given a pill in which will resolve his indecision. And I was you know, I picked up the book for precisely that reason, because that's my dream too. So,
Well, didn't he already make a decision to take the pill, right?
So well, his friend kind of gives it to him. So he that's the big decision he makes. It's true. He makes the decision to no longer be indecisive, takes the pill, and I don't want to spoil the book in case anyone reads it. I mean, it came out, you know, already 20 years ago. But anyway, that's one exploration of that sort of question. I wanted to see whether we can't historicize this maybe more explicitly, and not just in reference to very contemporary things of the past sort of 15 years of being able to order, you know, food and convenience and dating apps and that kind of thing, but maybe from a sweep from the kind of whole post-war period on, because you write in the piece, Amber, that, you know, this fantasy of omnipotence is an infantile thing. It's an impoverished and immature vision. Children's dreams of the pleasure of choice, adulthood is often confused with omnipotence. And where did this come from? Why did our society develop this fantasy of adulthood as omnipotence, which I assume was not so prevalent, you know, in the kind of pre-war era? My interpretation, for what it's worth, I mean, I don't know, is that, you know, from some point from the like 1950s, 1960s onwards, you have different kind of change in mores, change in child rearing practices and education, such that children are told they can be whatever they want to be, and then kind of maybe come to interpret that in a way which understands freedom in a kind of not productive sort of way, as freedom as the, you know, kind of maintenance of a million possibilities and choices or something like that. But I don't know, that's kind of my pop psychological semi-historical interpretation of it, and I could well be wrong about that.
Certainly I could be as well, but that broadly speaking aligns with my perspective. It's always hard when you think about human psychology to think about how much is perhaps just innate or hardwired and how much is socialization, you know, how much of who we are is very heavily contextual and historical and how much is more transcendent or innate. And look, I think there's something about being a child and looking at your parent, and you think, well, they get to make all the decisions. They get to do whatever they want. That's perhaps more innate, that the infantile freedom is wanting to not be a child, to be told what to do. Your parent gets to go to bed when they want to. You have to go to bed when you're told to. And so I think that's probably an element. And then, yes, this increasingly in the post-war era, message to children, you can do whatever you want to do and you can be whoever you want to be, versus historically, you're going to grow up and be one of these two things based on, you know, the class position you were born into, the gender you were born into, etc. And it's been a particularly important message for, and again, so general and sweeping, whatever, but for girls, for little girls in recent decades, that you can do whatever you want to do. You can be whoever you want to be. And on the one hand, as we're trying to just talk about the complexity here, how wonderful, what a good message. It is liberating. And on the other hand, what an awful lot of pressure. And a sort of message that might set you up to be quite disappointed.
Right. Yeah.
And then, so I guess there's a couple of questions here. Then if people are kind of set up to be disappointed like this, then is there a reversion to this infantile idea of freedom? Is this the general kind of social psychological process? Something else which it makes me think is that there is a decline of parental authority, or you know, you might not agree with this. I think happen to think it probably is true, that a decline in kind of the authority of the figure of the parent, which would mean that this kind of, I don't know, that would have to have an impact on how that infantile freedom is experienced as a child, because you don't have perhaps quite so clear an authority figure in the parent to kind of reject and eventually kind of replace in your own decision making. I'm not sure if this is really, if there is really a question here. It might be one of those kind of commenters question annoying things. I guess those are, I'll try and actually make into a question, two parts of the question, because I think this idea of infantile freedom is, I think, a really interesting one. The first is, yeah, what happens when, you know, maybe particularly young girls grow up and they've been told they can have it all, but actually, or you can be anything you want, but actually that's not the case for most people, because class determines occupation to a large extent. And secondly, is there a kind of a role of the decline of parental authority in how kind of infantile freedoms might be experienced?
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. Who knows? I think we're running an experiment with children about kids being more and more in the driver's seat with less and less parental authority, frankly. We'll see how that experiment plays out. But look, how do we prepare children to deal with the constraints of reality, or with the weight of responsibility, is perhaps a question. And what I just said is that kids historically maybe grew up wanting to be like the parent and imagining that it was more freeing than it might have been. That's one kind of psychological developmental experience. Nowadays, if we want to be dramatic about it, kids are the ones who get to do whatever they want, or they're in the driver's seat, which might make you want adulthood less, but also be less prepared for not getting what you want, actually. I found myself thinking as you were talking, George, about the contrast between my five-year-old nephew and thinking about the way I was raised, or certainly that my parents were raised, that my mother, you know, who was born in 1950, grew up not being allowed to have sodas or treats, and her mother had a little stash of Coca-Colas that were just for her mom and not for the children. And now my five-year-old nephew, there's the stash full of all of the treats are just for him, right? That kind of contrast, and what does that kind of prepare you for in terms of adulthood? And
that's fascinating, but it's something which, yeah, kind of I've kind of observed, or, you know, considered as well. I just wanted to maybe touch on one final notion in terms of how we understand constraint today as a kind of way of drawing this to a close. I tend to think that, you know, we're obviously the rollback, for example, of civil liberties, kind of widely commented on. We know this. We're kind of quite tolerant of, or if not tolerant, kind of grudgingly accepting of various different kind of constraints on our freedoms, and as well as kind of hopes and dreams for a kind of a better form of life. But what we don't tolerate, I think, is one, constraints on kind of consumer freedom, to the extent that they are seen as something kind of objective and external, not a personal failing, like, oh, I haven't worked hard enough, therefore I can't afford these things, but somehow an external imposition. Inflation, perhaps, certainly if the government takes something off the market for some reason, that's kind of a frustrating experience. But I think most of all, or really the starkest contrast, is the constraint of the normative kind, right? Where someone is critical of you or says, you know, you can't do that, or you shouldn't do that, or you should feel ashamed for doing that. We are really intolerant of that. We don't accept that. That's a kind of constraint, such as it is, that feels completely, you know, inexcusable, impossible, must be rejected, is the most old-fashioned kind of thing that could happen to us, and has to, and as progressives. And I don't think this is just kind of for kind of left or left liberal people, but I think people are more kind of conservative inclined feel maybe similarly as well, that certain normative impositions as they feel them are intolerable. And I don't know what to make of that. And I don't know if you have a kind of a psychoanalytic reading of why that is, but Why do people judging you and telling you your opinion is wrong feel like the worst curtailment of freedom we could suffer?
Mm-hmm. Gosh, what a good question. It again speaks to this very infantile notion of freedom to me that maybe politically and psychologically has displaced more adult and more nourishing conceptions of freedom. I very much know what you're talking about. This kind of no one should comment on my appearance and my emotionality, et cetera, right? That I should be able to express myself however I want to express myself. This real devaluing of normative per se, of collective institutions, rituals, ways of doing things, ethics, right? All of that has come so much under attack. And then how can we really be free if that dissolves in more robust political kinds of ways, right? And it's quite something to make the contrast that you're making, Alex, between the erosion of civil liberties and the constraints and, frankly, deprivation that we tolerate. And then this insistence on a different kind of freedom. Like, you think about healthcare. We don't have, I mean, how liberating is it to know that you have universal healthcare? In the United States, we don't have that. What a terrible kind of deprivation. In fact, I have a patient contemplating moving to Europe in part to have healthcare and maternity leave, et cetera, contemplating starting a family because it's so bad here. Mm. And yet we want the freedom to have everyone freeze their eggs. And so there's just so much to try to tease apart there. And the way that we, if we somehow won't allow ourselves in this country to have certain kinds of freedoms or options, because we've decided that that goes up against the free market or some kind of ideology that I think we've been deeply brainwashed around here, then we want to insist on these other kinds of freedoms. Another sort of example that came to my mind, I tend to think in examples and in terms of my clinical work, is during the pandemic, so many big tech companies telling people they could work from home. And now the tech companies are saying, well, this doesn't seem to be good for workplace culture, productivity, come on back. And people don't want to, even though they know that working from home is not making them well. It's bad for physical and mental health. It's like isolating, you're not moving your body, And then this really kind of, to me, is like very funny phenomenon where now people are renting WeWork spaces. So they're actually paying out of pocket to go work with other people because, you know, that's good for them, but they don't want the company to tell them to do it because it feels like a little bit of freedom vis-a-vis this company that, like, it's a job that they don't really like that much, but we're not thinking about, well, how can we organize collectively or be part of a union and make working conditions better or better sick leave or working hours or quality in other different kinds of ways. Like, we don't know how to have that conversation. So I'm going to die on the hill of, you know, being allowed to work from home, something like that.
No, absolutely. I think, well, it's so thought provoking. We could kind of continue this. Maybe we'll leave that here, and we're gonna resolve all these issues. But maybe I'll just make a gesture to another episode, which we did with Dustin Guastella, another kind of damage episode, where we discussed, you know, kind of antisocial socialism and a kind of general disposition against any normativity, any kind of normative vision of what the good society would be, which gets dissolved in place of the very limited freedom of consumer sovereignty, which itself gets quickly eroded by restrictions of civil liberties, by inflation, by various other things. So I think it might be worth trying to join those two things up, and maybe it also keep that in mind for a discussion for another time. Thank you very much, Amber. I'd say to, again, listeners, check out Damage Issue 3, Mothers. There's going to be, I don't know if I can announce this yet, but there'll be a launch party for people who are in New York. So watch the space. We'll be announcing it. And of course, on Damage sites and social media, it'll be announced. And of course, Amber's excellent article, Frozen Freedom, should definitely be read. All right, that's it from us for now. Thanks, both, and catch you later. Bye-bye.